So basically, we're going to be looking at the analogy between a classical theory with a constraint on how much you can know and the quantum theory for two-level systems. Well, collections of two-level systems, collections of qubits. So the starting point is you want to come up with a restriction on how much you can know. But we don't have as nice an uncertainty relation for qubits as we do for particles. So in the case of Heisenberg uncertainty relation, delta x, delta p, gradient equal to h bar over 2, you don't have something quite as nice because although there's a constraint on the variances of, say, the spin along the z-axis and the spin along the x-axis, it's a constraint that depends on the expectation value of jz. And it's not clear how to turn that into a constraint on classical distributions. So I'm going to go a different route, which is to come up with a sort of classical notion of complementarity. The first couple of slides in this talk are going to be technical, but after that, it's going to be a lot smoother. It's not so critical to understand all the details of the next couple of slides. It's the mathematical background to everything else that comes afterwards. So what is this constraint going to look like? So again, take a lead from quantum theory. So we know in quantum theory that observables, Hermitian operators that are jointly measurable, are commuting relative to the matrix commutator. So you might want to say, all right, let's come up with a constraint that says you can only jointly know certain classical observables if they satisfy some constraint. So what's a good analog to the commutator in a classical theory? The Poisson bracket, exactly. So this is the kind of restriction you could imagine. You're only able to jointly know two classical variables if they correspond to variables that commute relative to the Poisson bracket. Okay, so suppose you were doing this for continuous degrees of freedom. Then you have a configuration space, so you have n canonical degrees of freedom living in some configuration space. You can use that to define a phase space, just introduce momenta for every one of these degrees of freedom. And then you can introduce a Poisson bracket. You can introduce functionals on the phase space. So for example, x sub k would take a point in the phase space, so that's a point in this space here. So I'm using m to denote this vector. X sub k would take m and return the position of the kth system. And p sub k would return the momentum of the kth system. The Poisson bracket is defined for these kinds of functionals. All right? It basically has this form. So if I have two functionals, f and g, I take this combination of them. And that is a functional on the phase space. So I have to evaluate it at m. So hopefully that's familiar from a course in classical mechanics. Now, if you confine your attention to the linear functionals, okay, then linear in position and momentum, it means that an arbitrary functional that's linear will be written in this form with a's and b's coefficients for the position and momenta of the different systems. And if I write two different linear functionals down, and then I take their Poisson bracket, what I find is this particular combination of those coefficients, ad minus bc. So this coefficient of position for the first functional and this coefficient for momentum of the second functional. So position momentum minus momentum position. Yes?
In the Poisson bracket of functionals, the derivative yep. are respective to big x and big p.
That's right, yeah. So this f is some function of position and momentum
functionals.
Right. These are like the observables in a classical theory. Other questions? So this form of inner, you can think of this as each of these functionals is defining a vector on a phase space, right? I can think of these A's and B's now, well, these vectors here, as vectors in a phase space that's dual to the phase space up here. And this particular combination is called the symplectic inner product. It's an inner product that you can define on vector spaces that are phase spaces. So you can also think of the Poisson bracket as being associated with something called the symplectic inner product. Okay, so this is all classical. Now, what I want to do in this lecture is talk about spin systems and two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. So I'm going to use this kind of framework, but I'm going to do it for discrete degrees of freedom rather than continuous ones. So it turns out you can do all of this just by generalizing things. So take a discrete degree of freedom such that the configuration space now is not the reals, but the integers mod d. Okay, so this is a discrete system in the sense that you would use in computer science, that you have a d-level system. If it's two levels, then you have a bit. If it's three levels, the computer scientists call it a trip. It's just one discrete degree of freedom. And now you could imagine having n of them, and their configuration would just be a specification of an integer between 0 and d minus 1 for each of these guys. And then you can define a phase space, which is just by squaring that configuration space. So now you have a new degree of freedom, which you can think of as canonically conjugate to these discrete degrees of freedom. And let's denote that whole thing by m, as we did before. The functionals on this discrete phase space are now going to map you from a point in this space to an integer mod d. Okay, so yes?
So if we have a qubit, then we have two, or one x, which can take values 0 and 1. And then
yep.
For each of these, we define a corresponding p.
That's right. So far, there's no connection with quantum mechanics. I'm just saying I could write down a classical theory where instead of having a continuous position, I have a discrete position. And I have a momentum associated with that whose values span the same field as position. So, you know, what would this classical theory be useful for? I'm not sure. But by the end of the lecture, I'll try to construct something that's very much like quantum theory for qubits out of this model. And so it's going to turn out that if I take d equal to 2, right, so a two-level system, and I impose a restriction on how much you can know about where you are in the phase space of this two-level system, it's going to look a lot like quantum mechanics for two-level systems. That's where we're going. So you have discrete functionals. And now here's the tricky bit. The tricky bit is that I'm going to have to do this multiple times. Yes. Okay. I need to define a Poisson bracket, but I don't have a notion of partial derivative any longer because this is discrete. So I just do a finite difference version of the Poisson bracket. So here, Exi is just a vector in the phase space that's, you know, one in the direction corresponding to x sub I and zero in all other directions. So I shift my point in phase space by some amount, evaluate the functional there, minus the functional, the original point in phase space. Okay, so again, I confine my attention to the linear functionals. So they're going to be of this form now, but now the a's and b's, the coefficients of this guy, are all integers mod d. Then if I have two such functionals, I can calculate their Poisson bracket, this discrete Poisson bracket. And because things are linear, if I take f of m plus e minus f of m, I just get f at e here. And if I work this out, right, f at e sub xi, that is you know, 0 for all coordinates except the x sub ith. So only the x sub ith functional has value 1. So this returns just the coefficient of the x sub ith term in this functional. So again, I'm just going to get a sub I, d sub I minus b sub I, c sub I. So it looks exactly as it did before. The discrete Poisson bracket is giving me a symplectic inner product, but now on this vector space over a finite field. Okay? Question?
Can you choose a non-commutative module instead of set D?
You're welcome. You're welcome to try. I don't know what would happen. My target here was to get something very close to quantum theory for qubits, and I'll show you to what extent you can. The question of, you know, what would you get if you did something completely different is interesting, and I don't know. The whole subject of discrete phase space is relatively new. Only in the last few years have people been doing a lot of research on discrete phase spaces. So there's opportunities for studying interesting new possibilities. Yes?
Sorry, I'm not used to discrete classical systems.
Yes.
How is the conjugate momentum defined usually? Is there some way of just I mean,
do you mean?
I guess you start from.
You're thinking probably of a Lagrangian formulation, right, where you could define the canonical momentum in terms of canonical.
Or some intuition about it, right?
So I don't know. Here I'm introducing it. You know, so here I'm doing a kind of Hamiltonian framework where the position and the momentum are the fundamental degrees of freedom. However, I have seen some interesting papers, one in particular by John Baez, a student of his, which attempts to take a Lagrangian approach to discrete classical systems. So probably the answer to your question is in there. Okay, so this stuff is just to show you that it's possible to generalize the notion of a Poisson bracket to discrete classical systems in this way. And so now the restriction that's going to be imposed on how much knowledge you have of these classical systems is going to be of the following sort. The only statistical distributions that can be prepared correspond to knowing the values of a commuting set of variables relative to this Poisson bracket, and furthermore that have maximal entropy. So it's like what we did last time. We had that condition on the covariance matrix and a condition to maximize entropy. Here the condition on the covariance matrix has been replaced by just saying you can only know variables that are classically commuting relative to the Poisson bracket. So that's our starting point. That's the postulate, and now we're going to figure out what the consequences of that are. And you know, what I presented to you, you could do it for any D, and you could even do it for a continuous system. But I'm going to focus on bits, so D is equal to 2 for the rest of the lecture. Okay, so here's the idea. You have, for a single system, you have a configuration space which is just 0 and 1, and your phase space has just 4 points. Position takes value 0, 1, momentum takes value 0, 1. And now you can ask, well, what are all the linear functional? What are all the variables that are appropriate for the system? And the answer is just variables of the form ax plus bp, where a and b are chosen from the integers mod 2. And so there's only 3 different kinds of variables. There's x, p, and x plus p. The zero variable is uninteresting. So these are the only linear functionals that you have in this theory. And then you can ask, OK, which of them commute relative to this Poisson bracket we defined? And you find that none of them do. If you look at any pair, they fail to commute, which is just like what you would find if these were the regular position and momentum operators for a continuous degree of freedom in quantum mechanics, or in classical mechanics relative to the Poisson bracket. So what it means is that if you can only know a set of commuting variables, then in this case, you can only know the value of one of these variables. You can't know the value of any two of them. You can't know the value of all three. You can only know the value of one at any given time. So what kinds of states of knowledge can you have? Here they are. So I'm going to draw probability distributions over this phase space by coloring some of the squares. So what this means is that it's probability a half for being this point in phase space, probability a half for being this point, and zero everywhere else. That just makes it a lot easier than putting halves in these boxes. So all of the blues are going to be uniform distributions over the squares where they're found. So suppose you know x. Well, if you knew that x was equal to 0, then that would correspond to knowing it's not 1, so probability 0 here. And then you know nothing otherwise. You maximize entropy otherwise, so you know nothing about momentum, so it's uniform in this direction. If you knew that x was 1, then it's a uniform distribution over momentum, but up here. Similarly, if you know momentum, then it's vertical bars. But you could also know x plus p, and suppose you knew that x plus p was equal to 0. Well, this is modular arithmetic, so it means that x and p can take the value 0 and 0, or 1 and 1, because 1 plus 1 is equal to 0 mod 2. So those are the 2 points, 0, 0, and 1, 1, and you have a uniform distribution over them. Or you could have x plus p equal to 1, like so. Or you could know nothing. You could have none of these variables known, in which case you just have a uniform distribution over the whole phase space. And that's it. According to the postulate, this is all you could know in this theory. And now here's the connection with qubits. These are going to be the analogs of the following 3 bases for a qubit: the 0, 1 basis, the plus minus basis, which is defined down here, and what I call the plus I minus I basis, which is just 0 plus or minus I 1. And then this is the analog of the complete mixed state at the center of the block sphere. these three bases are picked out for a qubit because they're what's called mutually unbiased. If I take an element of one and I ask what's its overlaps with the elements of another, they're equal. So 0 has the same overlap with plus as it does with minus. I mean overlap squared. And similarly, 0 has the same overlap with plus I as it does with minus I. Yes?
So you're saying that this is going to be the hidden variable model for our qubit?
Not quite. So it's going to be very much like that. So what I'm going to show is that if you look at the phenomenology of this theory I'm defining, it's going to be qualitatively extremely similar to the phenomenology for qubits. But strictly speaking, there isn't a mathematical isomorphism between this theory and a subset of quantum theory for qubits. There's a small difference in there. So I'll be talking about that. It's not like what we had last time where I showed you a theory that ultimately was a hidden variable model for some subset of quantum theory, the Gaussian states. If we took D equal to 3, then we would have that. I'm not going to talk about that case. But there's this interesting difference that seems to arise between even and odd dimensional fields between whether you get to something that's a subset of quantum theory or not. Okay, so first point to note. I can take convex combinations of these guys. What is a convex combination? It says, suppose you take one thing with probability half and the other thing with probability half, what do you get? So if I say, look, I know that x is equal to 0 with probability half, and with probability half I know x is equal to 1, well, that's telling me I have no information about x. It's equally likely to be 0 or 1. So the overall distribution is uniform over the whole discrete phase space. But similarly, if I take probability half for p being equal to 0, probability half for p being equal to 1, I also get the uniform distribution. So once again, we see that in this kind of model, there are multiple decompositions of the completely mixed state into pure states. So these equations are the analogs of these three equations for qubits. And here we can make a distinction between pure epistemic states and mixed epistemic states. The idea is that the states where you have non-maximal knowledge, so that postulate says there's only so much you can know, if there's more room, you know, if you haven't learned a full set of commuting variables, then you're in a state of non-maximal knowledge, and you're in a mixed state. Whereas if you've basically saturated that bound and you know as many variables as you possibly can, then you're in a pure state. And there's only, so these guys are all pure states, this guy's a mixed state. There's only one way. You can't decompose this into other kinds of states of knowledge, a convex mixture of other kinds of states of knowledge. Okay, so I think that question came up a few lectures ago. You know, how should we, if pure quantum states are to be understood as states of incomplete information or something deeper, then what's the difference between mixed states and pure states? And the answer is that the pure states, you have incomplete knowledge, but you have more knowledge than for the mixed states. Yes?
Could I write the pure mixed state as more than two pure states with different convex supran?
You could take, say, an equal mixture of all six of those pure states.
Right.
That would be fine. But in this theory, there is no way to convexly combine non-orthogonal states. That's something you can do in quantum mechanics. You can take a convex combination of non-orthogonal states, and you can't do it here. Okay, so let's talk about the structure of the space of epistemic states. So according to this theory, there's four different ways that this system could be, four different ontic states. So this is the case where x is equal to 0, p is equal to 0, x is equal to 0, p is equal to 1, and so on. And if I take an arbitrary probability distribution over those four states, I'm going to get a tetrahedron. So I've tried to draw a tetrahedron here. This is the close end, close edge. This is the far edge. And everything you know can be, every possibility for knowing about the system can be represented as a point in this tetrahedron. And this is how I characterized the classical theory last week. So the idea of these theories where you impose a restriction on knowledge is you constrain yourself to something that's within that simplex. So if I look at the states of knowledge in the theory we're talking about, you know, this guy here is a uniform distribution of this guy and this guy. So he's the point that's halfway between these two. So it's the probability a half times this state and a half times that state. And similarly, this guy is the equal mixture of those two, and so on. So I get, if I basically draw out all those points, I have an octahedron that's embedded inside that tetrahedron. Now, I can't have any distribution within the octahedron. I can only have these seven different distributions I've drawn here. But this is the way in which you get an interesting state space by constraining yourself to something that's smaller than the simplex. So if I drop all this stuff and I just look at this epistemic state space, the analogy with the block sphere is clear. I've got just my completely mixed state and the north pole, the south pole, east pole, west pole, and so on. And that's all this theory contains. Yes?
This looks very much like what Kepler tried to do initially. We're trying to model the ellipses by nesting some of the platonic solids in. Anyway, this is.
It does involve platonic solids, that's true. Okay, so moving on, the questions we now ask, so this is familiar, you know, what measurements are allowed if we're going to respect this postulate we set down? And it's going to be any commuting set of canonical variables are the ones you can measure. So if I measure x, I'm just going to denote that as, you know, one of your outcomes corresponds. If the ontic state is in this green region, then that'll give you outcome 0. If the ontic state is in the red region, it'll give you outcome 1. Similarly for p and for x plus p. So very simple. These are the analogs of the three bases you can measure for a qubit. And now you can ask, well, what about transformations? What are the kinds of dynamics that are allowed if you have to satisfy that postulate that you can never know too much? And the answer is that you want to preserve the Poisson bracket, or in other words, preserve the symplectic inner product. So you're going to allow any transformation on that discrete phase space which preserves the symplectic inner product. And it turns out that that's the group of what are called symplectic affine transformations, sometimes known as the Clifford group. They're defined in this way. I take a point in the discrete phase space to S times that point, some matrix S plus A, some vector in the phase space. It's symplectic if acting S on the point in phase space in this inner product preserves the inner product, and the affine bit means I can add this extra shift in the phase space. This is just the Heisenberg-Weil group part of the transformation. So again, the mathematical technicalities. Yes?
I was just going to ask about a mathematical technicality.
Oh, good, yeah.
The word symplectic has come up a lot, and I don't quite understand what it means. Could you give like a simple definition of like what's important about it being symplectic to us?
Okay, so if you define a symplectic inner product as just, so let's say I'm in a phase space that's, you know, very simple, just x and p, and then I have 2 points in that phase space. Okay, so I'll call one of the points x1, p1, and the other two x2, p2. Then your symplectic inner product is just a product between those points. Let me write it like this. Which is x1, p2 minus p1, x2. So it's not the regular Euclidean inner product, which would have been just, you know, x1, x2, plus p1, p2. So it's a different kind of inner product. It's anti-symmetric. And so you can start asking, well, if I have a vector space and I have this funny notion of inner product, you know, what can I say? You can develop a mathematical theory of those kinds of vector spaces.
Then it's a symplectic vector space.
And then it's called a symplectic vector space. That's right. And furthermore, in group theory, you can talk about the symplectic group, which corresponds to transformations on such vector spaces. And the symplectic group has a particular character. So those are the places where you know, the term symplectic comes up in mathematics. All classical theories are basically defined on symplectic vector spaces. as long as it's a Hamiltonian theory, and those are all the theories that we know to be useful for describing the world, it has that symplectic structure.
And it really just means it has an anti-symmetric product.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of ways of cashing it out. You know, it means that I can write the dynamics, you know, according to Hamilton's equations. So I have a canonically conjugate coordinate for every coordinate in the theory, and I can write out the dynamics in terms of Hamilton's equations. When you get to discrete phase spaces, you know, some of these things have to change, right? So we won't have Hamilton's equations because we don't have differentials here. But as I was saying in response to Tibra's question earlier, there's been a certain amount of work done trying to generalize all those notions to discrete classical systems. So certainly you can define a discrete, a symplectic vector space where the field over which the vector space is defined is a discrete field, and that's what I'm doing here. Other questions?
The symplectic affine transformation, is this what in physics language we call canonical transformation or contact transformation? Is that what you mean?
Yes. Okay, so again, the mathematical technicalities won't be important for what's coming next, but you know, it's nice to see in the background. If you work out what do these transformations look like on my simple phase space, it turns out that it's all 24 permutations of the four ontic states are valid transformations. So it means anything goes. Any one-to-one map over these ontic states is a valid map. Doesn't disobey the postulate, which sort of makes sense. If you have, if you thought of those six states of knowledge that were allowed, if I do any permutation, well, it's just going to move the two things, the two blue blocks around somewhere, and I'm going to get some other valid state. Okay, so let's start looking at what those transformations, what character they have. You know, if I take an arbitrary one, like a three cycle here, so this state moves here, this state moves here, this state moves there, and then I ask, what does it look like in this block sphere-like picture? So now, this is a transformation over ontic states. This is a transformation over epistemic states. It says if I start out knowing that x is equal to zero, so here's my information, and then I know that this transformation is applied, well, what do I know at the end of the day? So I could just, you know, figure out where each of these blocks goes. So this bottom right goes up here, and this bottom left moves over, so I'm definitely going to go here. And if I apply this again to this one, it shifts me over here, and this one shifts back here. So I get a three cycle over the epistemic states. And I get a similar three cycle here. And so now that starts to look like a unitary transformation of the block sphere. It's a rotation by 120 degrees about the x plus y plus z direction. Okay, so the point in these kinds of theories, there's some physical transformation that's happening to the hidden variables, and it induces a transformation in your knowledge of those hidden variables, also a deterministic transformation. And you know, according to this way of thinking about things, perhaps unitaries are like that. They're transformations in our knowledge, not transformations in the underlying reality. They're transformations in our knowledge that are induced by the second kind of transformation. If you look at a pair of two cycles, like this one, then it's easy to show that, you know, this state of knowledge is going to transform to this one's going to go here, and these guys are going to stay invariant. So that looks like a rotation by 180 degrees about this x-axis. Again, that's a kind of transformation that we see on the block sphere. But one of the ways in which this theory doesn't map onto quantum mechanics is that there are other transformations which don't correspond to rotations in this picture. So if I take a two cycle like this one, it corresponds to this map here, which is a reflection about the plane that is perpendicular to, or that is normal to the z plus y direction. And, this plane here. That's something that you don't have in the block sphere. Reflections about a plane are not valid unitary transformations. And similarly with four cycles, you get something which is a rotation, but it also involves this reflection here in between these two states. Okay, so we're not going to be getting the quantum theory of two-level systems out of this, but we're getting something similar. If you look at all the 24 permutations and you plot them out in this block sphere picture, this is what they look like. It includes the identity. It turns out it's just the symmetries of the tetrahedron under rotations and reflections, because ultimately, the tetrahedron is the space of physical states, and we know that these transformations are transformations of the physical states. Good. Questions about that? Something we saw in quantum mechanics, which is reproduced here, is the fact that not only do mixed states get represented as convex mixtures of pure states in many different ways, but there are irreversible transformations. So these are the ones that were associated with completely positive maps that weren't unitary in the quantum case. And they each had many decompositions into unitaries. So similarly here, you can imagine a transformation where these two epistemic states are unchanged, but everything else gets mapped to the state of no knowledge. And that can be obtained by doing nothing with probability half, or rotating about z by probability half. So these correspond to two different physical transformations you can do. And if you don't know which one's happened, then this is what happens to your knowledge. But there are other decompositions as well. OK, so the final question that you have to ask is, well, what happens to your state of knowledge if you do a measurement? After the measurement's over, what do you know? So how do you update your epistemic state after one of these measurements? So it's going to be like last time. I'm going to argue that if you imagine that there's no disturbance, then you have a problem. You violate the postulate. So imagine you do this measurement here, which just is measuring basically momentum. And suppose you get the P is equal to zero outcome, the red outcome. And suppose that your initial knowledge was that the position is zero. Well, regularly you would say, I knew it was x equals zero. I learned P is equal to zero. Therefore, I know it's in that bottom left corner. And similarly, if I'd known that x was equal to 1, I would infer that it was in this top left-hand corner. But each of these states of knowledge violates the postulate. And so that can't be how you update your information. It has to be that at the end of the day, this is what your information looks like. It's uniform distribution over x equals 0 and x equals 1, because this is the only probability distribution that makes the outcome of this measurement repeatable. So if we want this measurement to be like in quantum mechanics, such that if I repeat it, I'll continue to get that same outcome, then this would be the better be the final state of information. And the only way to ensure that is if, by virtue of doing this measurement, either there's no disturbance to the system, or this particular two-cycle gets applied, where you change the x value. You just add 1 mod 2. And if you do that, then say you measure this guy, you get to this state, but then with probability half, it swaps over here, and so overall you know nothing about what its x position is. So again, in this theory, measurements of momentum cause an unknown disturbance to position. It's just now we have discrete position and momentum. Yes?
I see how this theory works by your qubit case.
Yes?
Is it also generalized
here in the SU10 qubit case? Yeah, we'll see that shortly. Okay, so very analogous to what we saw yesterday, just for a discrete system now. So now here's an interesting question you're going to ask, which is, what is the analog of coherent superposition? So one of, I would say, the stumbling points for the view that quantum states are states of knowledge is that people say, well, it makes sense to talk about convex combination, but what could coherent superposition possibly be in such a theory? Now, usually we think of coherent superposition in entirely mathematical terms, first and foremost. So we have a vector space, the Hilbert space, and we take a particular coherent superposition of vectors, and we just look at the vector that results. But in the theory I'm developing, there's no vector space, right? So how are you going to define coherent superposition? Another way of thinking about it is that if you look at the Bloch sphere picture rather than looking at Hilbert space, then you might say, well, how do I define a notion of coherent superposition in a language that's native to the Bloch sphere? OK, well, one way to do it is as follows. You could say an equal superposition of two orthogonal states, 0 and 1, is obtained by implementing on the first state, 0, a square root of any unitary that maps 0 to 1. So for example, a rotation about y by pi will map the state 0 to 1. So will a rotation, I should say pi as well, a rotation by pi about the x-axis. And now if I take the square root of each of those transformations, well, there's actually two square roots for this rotation. I can rotate about y by pi by 2 or minus pi by 2. And each of those squared will give me this rotation, similarly here. And if I apply each of these rotations to my original state 0, then what I'm left with are coherent superpositions of 0 and 1. So it's basically, you can think, coherent superposition is going halfway between these two orthogonal states through the space of states. So this kind of notion of coherent superposition does have an analog in the theory we're talking about. So now I have no vectors, no vector space, but I have these probability distributions. And I can say, well, let's just define an equal superposition of these guys to be what you get by implementing the square root of some permutation that maps this guy to this guy. So remember, the transformations here are permutations of these four states. So here's a pair of permutations, the only two permutations that'll take you from this one to this one. And if you look at the square roots of them, it's four cycles. So each one has a pair of four cycles. If I apply this twice, I go here and then I go here. So this guy gets mapped to here as here. And if I apply this one twice, you know, he goes to there, and so on. So each of these is the square root of this one. So if I apply each of these transformations to my original state, then I get the four states that lie in the equator of the block sphere picture. So you can try to generalize that notion to cases of more than one system. The bottom line, so I don't know if I should go into the technical details of this. Maybe I'll skip the technical details. The bottom line is that the way you interpret coherent superposition in one of these models is that, you know, you resist the temptation to say it's something simple like this or this, or this and this. It's a more subtle relation. It says, take the set of ontic states that are consistent with this state of knowledge, and take the set of ontic states that are consistent with this set of knowledge, and take an element of this one and an element of that one, and combine them into a new epistemic state. So it's like saying, you know, take a bit from each and recombine them. And there are different ways of doing that. And so there are different notions of coherent superposition. So I can take 0 plus 1, or 0 minus 1, or 0 plus I1, or 0 minus I1. So all those different relative phases correspond to different ways that you can take subsets of this guy and this guy and combine them into a new state. Yes?
When we talk about these kinds of models,
yes,
where we talk about states of knowledge, we still take the postulate that somehow our knowledge is limited. So you somehow postulate that, you know, the knowledge you can have about two variables at the same time is limited by some number.
That's right.
And it seems that, you know, you're not really dealing with the problem where that postulate came from.
True.
So is there... I mean, why does this help us with the dilemma of, you know, getting axioms for quantum mechanics or understanding quantum mechanics better even? Like, it's still a puzzle. Why?
True. So I agree. If your purpose was to come up with an axiomatic derivation of quantum mechanics, then, well, for any axiomatic derivation, you can always say, well, try to explain that axiom. So in this sort of approach, you can always say, you know, why that postulate? You might still be making axiomatic progress by saying, actually, you know, this postulate together with a bunch of, you know, maybe some framework, some background framework of consistency or minimal assumptions, this postulate sort of does so much work that clearly we've made some progress. You know, we've learned something through this kind of axiomatization. But that doesn't stop you from asking deeper questions like why. Nonetheless, you can think of this in a different way. It's a project about interpretation. So if you start from a classical theory and start imposing extra postulates and build up towards quantum theory, then one thing that's nice about starting with the classical theory is that we don't have any interpretational debates about classical theories. We sort of know what kind of world the classical theory is describing. And so if we can get quantum mechanics out the other end, then we think that we'll be able to understand, you know, what it's saying about the world. We'll have an interpretation that comes out. You know, whereas if you just... whereas if you think of classical theory as emerging from quantum theory, then you might say, well, whatever the interpretational difficulties of quantum theory are, you know, you won't have solved them. You'll just inherit them in your classical theory. So does that answer your question?
Sort of. It just seems like a particularly... troublesome postulate to carry over, you know, if you're trying to gain a better, like, realist understanding. Yeah.
Well, it's not a postulate that was true of quantum theory. I mean, operational quantum theory never had an uncertainty principle in it that said, you know, you can't know the position and the momentum simultaneously, because it didn't even acknowledge that there were such things as position and momentum. So it's sort of, it's motivated by some operational fact about quantum theory. And it might sound like what Heisenberg was talking about in the early days. You know, Bohr and Heisenberg both sometimes spoke as if there was a position momentum and we couldn't know them simultaneously. But it's adding something to those elements of quantum theory. I mean, I share your dissatisfaction with just starting there, but you know, this is the state of the art, so I wish I could give you a better answer, but I can't. Other questions? Yes?
Yeah, I don't know if it's appropriate, but last year we saw a colloquium by Ben Schumacher about modular field theory, modular quantum mechanics, and it looked a bit like that. Is it different?
Yes, it's very different, actually. Ben's work is really done within the framework of operational theories. So he is, the mathematical formalism he introduces is strictly speaking only to be interpreted as representing preparations and measurements. And there's no way to think of it as information about some underlying classical states. But it does have a lot of features in common with this theory. So this is basically telling you about some work I did in 2004. And what it shares in common is that you can argue that this is not really a probabilistic theory at all, because every probability distribution that appears is a uniform probability distribution. So you could just get away with saying the ontic state is this or this or this, and all you really need is modal logic. You need disjunctions of things. And so some people call those kinds of theories possibilistic. So you never have probabilities, you just have possibilities. So each one of these tells you what the possibilities are. And Ben's theory is also a possibilistic theory.
Yeah, because in modular theories, the problem is we cannot assign probabilities without having inconsistencies. Do we get rid of this with this kind of theory?
It is like Ben's theory, as far as you can't introduce arbitrary probability distributions here. I have a certain, so many people ask me, you know, why not introduce arbitrary convex combinations of, say, this state of knowledge and this state of knowledge as valid ways of knowing about the system? And there are a few answers to that question. One is that, you know, the postulate I set down talked about having, you know, knowledge of some variables and no knowledge of the other variables, maximum entropy for the other variables. So I'd have to come up with a different postulate that would allow those other distributions as valid. But more importantly, I want this theory to have a kind of internal consistency similar to what we saw with the von Neumann chain. You can ask, is it possible to build a coin in this kind of world that would have, say, probably 3/4 of head and 1/4 for tail? And to do that, you need, you know, to be able to start with one of these kinds of systems and then couple it to another system and do one of two different things, 3/4 of the time and 1/4 of the time. And it just turns out that there's basically no way of building these coins. So if you assume that you can prepare arbitrary distributions of this and this, you're giving yourself more freedom than the theory allows you. You're saying, well, externally, I could imagine sort of a classical world where I flip a coin and do this or this. But that coin is not built of the same stuff as these systems are. So that's why I think it's not natural to extend it to full probability theory. Okay, so I'm just going to skip the next slide because it was just more about this coherent superposition. Here's a small point about interference. So one way of thinking about coherent superposition is in terms of interference experiments. So the story goes, you know, if I prepare 0 and I measure the plus minus basis, I get 50-50 statistics. Similarly for the state 1, if I prepare a coherent superposition and measure the plus minus basis, I get the plus outcome 100% of the time. So a criticism that's often made of the notion that these could possibly be probability distributions or epistemic is that what could this possibly be besides this or this, in which case how could I get destructive interference, which would tell me suddenly the minus outcome is impossible, right? If it's this or this, then it should still be possible to get that minus outcome. The answer this kind of theory provides is that this coherent superposition is the analog of not this or this, but rather this funny way of combining these two states of knowledge into a new state of knowledge, where you take one option from here and one option from here and combine them together. And that clearly can give you this destructive kind of interference wherein you never get the green outcome.
Is there a description for how to
see
one possibility?
There is, and that's sort of the slide I skipped over. I think it would just take too much time to describe it, but you can define sort of four different kinds of ways of combining two epistemic states, which map on to plus, minus, plus I, minus I, those four phases. And for any state you put in, you can figure out what, for any orthogonal states you put in, you can figure out what comes out. So yeah, there is a generic way of doing it, but I don't think it's worth going into. Yes?
So how do you generate without the states that we know in normal quantum mechanics as an arbitrary axis?
You can't. You can't do it. So you might say, you know, what's the significance of that? You know, you can't get the full quantum theory for a two-level system. I think at the end we should talk about what that is, what lesson we should take from that.
So is that a problem, or?
Well, it's certainly a problem if, you know, you were hoping to interpret quantum theory as just a classical theory with a restriction on how much you can know. In that sense, yes, it's a problem. You haven't reached the target. But if your objective was to try to get clear on what the character of quantum states are, then you might say, well, all this is evidence that whatever the correct interpretation is, the character of quantum states ought to be epistemic, not ontic. So you might just see it as this is a step towards getting on the right path for interpretation, as opposed to figuring out, you know, extending this to characterize quantum mechanics totally. Yes?
So does the fact that you can't obtain the full quantum theory from this have to do that we are all using somehow real structures while the structure of the quantum theory is complex?
I don't think so, no. It's going to have more to do with phenomena of nomicality and contextuality, which we're going to talk about later this week. And those phenomena can exhibit themselves even if the states and the measurements you're looking at are all real amplitude. So you don't need to have complex numbers to see those phenomena. Okay, so we had a question earlier, what about more than one system? So now I want to say something about pairs of bits. So it's going to be, so for a pair of bits, we now have, you know, these four linear functionals. And an arbitrary canonical variable is some linear combination of them where the coefficients are chosen from the integers mod 2. And now the trick is that if I really wanted to draw nice pictures, I would have to do it in a four-dimensional vector space, and that's hard to do. So I'm going to cheat, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to map this two-dimensional vector space onto a line. So I'm going to write out the position of the momentum along a line. So this is, you know, position 0, momentum 0, position 0, momentum 1, and so on. So I've basically just unstacked this. The top is going to the right of it. And then I can represent this guy as just a 4x4 grid, where I have the position of momentum of the first particle and the position of momentum of the second particle along the vertical and the horizontal axes. And so that'll allow me to draw similar pictures. So just to kind of get clear to be able to understand these pictures, note that now instead of having my little diagrams over these 2x2 grids, everything is going to be 1x4. So I've just shifted the top to the right on each of these cases. So this is how you should think of the six different pure states now. Okay, so what kinds of states of knowledge can you have for two of these systems? Well, if you look at all these different variables, it's now possible to find two of them that commute relative to this discrete Poisson bracket. So an example would be any variable for the first system and any variable for the second system. They always commute, just like in quantum mechanics, variables for different systems commute. So you could have that the position of the first is known and the momentum of the second is known. That's a valid state of knowledge. So if you ask, well, what does that correspond to? Well, here's what knowing the position of the first particle to be zero corresponds to. It's uniform over x1 equal to 0. It's so uniform over the momentum for the first particle and uniform over the position and the momentum for the second. And similarly, if I know p2 to be 0, then that means I have this distribution. But I can know them both. And so everything that's excluded by each of these has to be excluded. And so this is my overall state of knowledge if I know that pair. And that's the analog of having a product state, the state 0 for the first and plus for the minus. But there's a different way of having joint knowledge of two systems. I could know a variable that's a joint variable between the two systems. So if I know x1 plus x2, I don't know x1 and I don't know x2, but I know what their sum is. So if I know that their sum is 0, for example, then that puts me in one of these 8 points. So, you know, x1 is 0 here and x2 is 0 here, x1 is 1 here, x2 is 1 here, and 1 plus 1 is 0 in modular arithmetic. I could also know the sum of their momenta, and that puts me in one of these spots. And if I know both of those things, then I get this distribution. Okay, so this is now, I know if I look at the marginals for the first particle, it's totally uniform. And the marginal for the second particle is totally uniform. So I know nothing about each particle individually, but I know everything there is to know about the relationship between them. This is the analog of the EPR state, right. And for the case of two spins, you know, that's like the analog of the singlet state. So there it is, the 0, 0 plus 1, 1 state, or the 0, 1 plus 1, 0 state. The difference between these two kinds of distributions, this one and this one, is the same as the difference between product states and entangled states in the following sense. The two systems are uncorrelated when you have this kind of knowledge. If I update my knowledge about system one here, so Alice measures this observable, so this is measuring momentum on this particle. Say she gets the red outcome. Well, the second particle, her information about it hasn't changed. So she's going to update her distribution on her particle to, you know, momentum zero, but her description of the faraway system doesn't change, just as it is in quantum mechanics. Whereas if she gets the red outcome here, sorry, if she gets the red outcome in the second case, then clearly she learns something about the second system. She knows that, you know, it's not here in this second row, and it's not here. Therefore, it's not here, and it's not here. So she knows that the second particle has to be in one of these two states. So she updates her information to this, which is like the plus-plus state in quantum theory. And that's exactly what you get if you measured plus on the first system, you would update your description of the second system to plus as well. So that's like the remote collapse postulate that you saw in tutorials or homework assignments. These are all the uncorrelated states. There's 6 possibilities for the left system and 6 possibilities for the right system. There are 24 different ways of having a line through the space. So these are all the entangled states in this theory. And note that if you look at states of non-maximal knowledge for 2 bits, you don't have just a unique state. You have many states now. So this is a state where you only know the position of the first particle. And that's a state of non-maximal information. You can still learn one extra variable. Or here, you only know the momentum of the second particle. There are also states of non-maximal knowledge that have correlation between two systems. So here again, you only have knowledge of x1 plus x2. So there's more you could know. And here, you only have knowledge of p1 plus p2. So these are the analogs of 0 tensor, the complete mixed state tensor plus. This is the analog of an incoherent mixture of the product state 0, 0, that's this guy, and the product state 1, 1, that's this guy, or an incoherent mixture of plus, plus, and minus, minus. So there's 2 kinds of correlations in this theory. There's an analog of pure entanglement, that's this guy, and there's an analog of this, what in quantum information people sometimes call classical correlation. And the real difference is that here, there's certain measurements I can do that will lead me to update the second system. So if I measure in the you know, x basis, right, so I measure position here versus here, then that'll teach me what the position of the second particle is. But if I measure the momentum and I get 0, so I know I'm here or here, well, the marginal for the second particle is uniform, so I don't learn anything about the second particle if I measure momentum. Just as with this state, if I measure 0, I update the second particle, but if I measure plus versus minus, I get no extra information about the second particle. So according to this approach, that's the difference between having entanglement and not having entanglement. It's a question of the strength of the correlations. But there's no real difference in kind between those sorts of objects. Okay, so we're getting near the end. If you ask for two systems, what are the transformations that the postulate allows? Well, you can have transformations on just system one or transformations on just system two. Here's a case where you combine both of these. You just take the composition of those two guys. It looks like this. So that's the analog of products of unitaries. But you also have transformations like this one here, which happens to look to be like a controlled knot, which is not a product of unitaries. Those are the kinds of operations in quantum mechanics that entangle. If you start with the product states, it makes them entangled. So this is the thing that will take you from an uncorrelated state of knowledge to a correlated one. And then you can work out what all the transformations are. It's not the set of permutations of 16 elements. It's a subset of those. So it's, again, described by this symplectic affine group. If you draw it out just for fun, you get all these crazy patterns together with permutations of the rows and columns. And I don't know why I show you this, just because I had a summer student who drew these once, and I, you know, this is in tribute to him that I show you those things. And then if you ask what are the measurements, again, you know, same principle. It's measurements of two variables that commute relative to the Poisson bracket. And in these diagrammatic form, you know, this is like a measurement of the 0-1 basis on the left and the 0-1 basis on the right for in quantum mechanics. This is another measurement of a product basis. But then you can also have measurements every element of which is an entangled state, right? So like the green and the orange, they're all, each of those correspond to entangled states. So that's like your Bell basis measurements. You can do those as well. OK, so I'll end with a few of the phenomena we've seen thus far in quantum mechanics and how they appear in this simple picture, because I think this is so simple that it makes these things more intuitive even than the stuff we were talking about yesterday. So remember the no-cloning theorem. If I have a set of states psi I and I couple them to some other state chi, there's no evolution in quantum mechanics that will take me to psi I, tensor psi I, if I is unknown. So one example for a qubit would be if the set is just the one state or the plus state, so these are non-orthogonal, and I want to, and my second system starts in the zero state, there's no way I can take 1, 0 to 1, 1 and plus 0 to plus plus without knowing what this state is. And the reason, as we saw last time, is that if I look at the overlaps of these guys, I get a half. If I look at the overlaps of these guys, I get a quarter. So it's not unitary. So here's the analog. Now my epistemic states are a pair of points in the discrete phase space. So let me call those points AI and BI. So this just means OR. So it's point AI or point BI. And I want a map that will take me from my unknown epistemic state with some fixed state to a pair of those unknown states. Well, now let's look at the picture, because it makes things really simple. So the extra system, I'll say, starts out in this state, where position is 0. And the two possibilities are my non-orthogonal states of knowledge. Here I know that x is equal to 1. I'm on the top. Here I know that p is equal to 0. So that's like the plus state. And what I want to map them to is a case where the profile over the second system matches the profile over the first. So here, the profile over the second system should go to these two. And the profile over the second system, in this case, should go to the final two. OK. Now look at the overlap of these guys. Here, they overlap in these two spots. Over here, they overlap in just one spot. So clearly, if I look at a permutation of these 16 elements, there's no way that you know, these two are going to be mapped to one element. So there's no way I can do a physical transformation on these guys that will get me from these two possibilities to those two possibilities, which is just another way of saying that their overlaps are different, and so it can't be done. Let's look at the EPR effect. So remember, in quantum mechanics, if you prepare two qubits in the 0, 0, plus 1, 1 state, and then Alice measures the 0, 1 basis on her half, she collapses her and the distance system to either 0, 0, or 1, 1. If she measures plus minus, she collapses their two systems into plus plus or minus minus. And the analog is we start with this kind of probability distribution. Alice either measures position, discrete position, or discrete momentum. And if she gets the red outcome, for example, then you know, we saw she either does identity or a flip. You know, that's her disturbance. So she leaves her own system in this distribution, and she updates her information about the distance system to be one of these two guys. Because she knows it's not one of these two, so she knows it couldn't have been in one of those states. And similarly, if she gets the green outcome, she updates to this. If she measures this, then she updates to one of those. But all along, let's say the ontic state was here. Then what would happen is she just learns that it's here, you know, by doing this measurement. She learns it's one of these two. And she updates her information about the distant system to it being one of these two. Whereas here, if it was here all along, then she gets the green outcome. She learns it was one of these two. And she updates her knowledge about the distant system to it being one of these two. So again, it's just a question of refining her information about the distant system in one of two ways, depending on how she's chosen to probe the system in her lab. Because she can't find out everything about the system in her lab, so she has to make a choice. What kind of information am I going to get? So the final example is teleportation. And I'm curious if anybody's gotten to that problem on the homework assignment yet. Some of you. Okay, so let me remind you how it works. This is a very schematic sketch of it. There are three particles in this protocol. They're all qubits. So two of them are prepared in a singlet state. One is sent to Alice, who's over here, and the other is sent to Bob, who's over here. So this is Alice's lab, this is Bob's lab. Alice gets another system from somebody else. We usually call him Victor. He's the verifier. He makes sure that they do the teleportation right. So he sends a system to Alice, and he doesn't tell her what state he's prepared it in. It could be any quantum state. Alice takes her half of the entangled pair with Bob and the system she's been given and measures them in the Bell basis. And then depending on which outcome she got, she sends one of four messages over to Bob. So that's two bits of information. And then Bob does a unitary on his half to one of four poly operations, depending on the message he got from Alice. And at the end of the day, the final state over on Bob's side is exactly the state that was fed in here, the quantum state. So whatever Victor described the system as, Victor would now describe the final state of Bob's system in that same way. That's teleportation. And I guess I'll be giving away slightly one of the questions in the homework, but what people find confusing about this is that there are an infinite number of different quantum states that you could feed in here. And it takes more than two bits of information to describe pick out one possibility from an infinite number. And yet, Alice has only sent two bits of information over to Bob. So how could Bob possibly recreate the quantum state here, given that only two bits of information have propagated between them? You know, the preparation of this entangled state had to be done at a time prior to Victor even deciding which state he's going to prepare this in. So it can't contain information about what the state is here. So any information would have to be in those two bits that were sent from Alice to Bob. So that's the standard mystery. And the epistemic approach resolves that mystery in the following way. So let's look at the analog. The analog is we prepare two of these systems in a correlated state, one of these analogs of entangled states. And then we measure the two in the analog of the Bell basis, so a measurement every outcome of which corresponds to one of these entangled states. So think about what's going on here. What do you know ahead of time? You know that these two systems are in the same physical state. Wherever one is in its phase space, the other one's in the same point in phase space. But you know nothing about where that is. The marginal on each of these guys is uniform. But you know they're the same. And then you do this measurement here. And let's say you get the green outcome. Well, that tells you that the ontic state of this system is the same as the ontic state of that system. So they're at the same point in phase space. So what can you conclude? You conclude that this guy must be in the same ontic state as this guy. Because this green outcome tells you these guys are the same. This tells you that these two are the same. So you know this guy's the same as this guy. So whatever knowledge Victor might have had of this one, you can now assure Victor your knowledge will also apply to this. You might have been uncertain about the ontic state, but I assure you this guy's in the same ontic state. Therefore, whatever knowledge you have now applies on this guy. If you get the orange outcome instead, you say, oh, well, that means that this system has a physical state that's different from this one, but I know exactly what the difference is. If you can think of it as sort of, it's one grade. If I just label the physical states 1, 2, 3, 4, it means that the first system has a physical state that has a label one higher than the other. So you can send a message to Bob and say, oh, just change the label, do the transformation that would change the label, and then you'll be left in the same state as the first system here. So for each of the ways you could find these two systems being related, you can tell Bob to update his system such that the ontic state of this guy and the ontic state of that guy are now the same. And then whatever knowledge somebody has about this system will apply to that system. So what's happened here is effectively there are only four physical states in this model. So it's possible with two bits of information to describe the physical state of a system. But you can never measure the physical state of a system. You can't say, oh, it's definitely one of these four, because the postulate forbids it. But it is possible to be clever and say, I'm just going to measure the relationship between this guy and this guy, and I'm going to communicate information about that relationship over to Bob, and then Bob will be able to manipulate his system such that even though at no point did we know what the physical state was, we can be sure at the end of the day that the physical state of this final system is the same as the one of the initial system. Yes?
So in some sense, what we're doing here is that what Alice is doing is she's measuring the relationship between the system that was given by Victor and the bell basis and just conveying that information to Bob, and Bob is just doing...
That's right. She's measuring the relationship between this system and this system. Each one of them has four physical states, and she's saying, you know, so she could basically be measuring things like the sum of their positions and the sum of their momenta. And if she finds zero for both the sum of their positions and the sum of momenta, she says, oh, okay, so whatever the position momentum of this guy is, this is the same. And then she can assure Bob, the position momentum of your system is the same as mine. But if she finds the sum of their positions is one and the sum of their momenta is zero, okay, then she knows that this guy has a different position from this guy. So she tells Bob, add one to the position, modulo two, and then the position of this guy is the same as the position of this guy, and so they're back into the same physical state.
And in some sense, that's exactly what's happening in quantum mechanics.
That's going too far. This argument's not saying this is a model of what's happening in quantum teleportation, because this can only capture, you know, six of the pure quantum states. You know, there's a lot more than six quantum states in the real theory. This is pointing out is that if, you know, the theory of qubits was just those, you know, six quantum states, then we would have a very simple hidden variable model for what was going on in teleportation, and there would be nothing mysterious about it. But it's not a full interpretation of the quantum theory. Okay, final note. Last time we showed that if you write down a Wigner representation of quantum states, in fact a particular subset of quantum states, you could find that the Wigner representation of those quantum states mapped on directly to the probability distributions in that classical theory we had defined. So you can ask the same thing here. Could it be that there's a discrete Wigner representation for a subset of qubit states which maps on exactly to these probability distributions? Well, it turns out there is a subset of the quantum states that look a lot like the ones I've been telling you about, and they're used in quantum information theory. They're called the stabilizer states. I won't go into why we use that terminology, but there's the same number of those quantum states as there are probability distributions here. The group of transformations is exactly the same, so there's this tight map between them, but they're not the same theory. It turns out that you introduce this discrete Wigner function, and you find that it goes negative for some of those stabilizer states. So the conclusion is that this theory I've been telling you about today is similar to, but not equivalent to, that subset of quantum theory. So there's something a bit different going on here. But the close analogy suggests that maybe this idea that quantum states ought to be thought of as knowledge of something else is a good one. Maybe the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics has that flavor. It might not be knowledge about the particular phase space we've described here, but perhaps the very notion that it is a description of knowledge is a worthwhile one that we should pursue, and perhaps it would help us get a better interpretation of quantum mechanics. And I think I'll end there. Questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Just about the EPR effect.
Yes.
The thing is, if you say, like in your picture, if you say that the one at a particular state, then if you combine both information about the measurement, you can say in which state it went before, which contradicts.
So say it again. You're worried about finding out everything about the particle's position and momentum.
Yeah, because if you find, for example, that
you find a zero and the other one measure a minus.
Yes.
So if the two systems are correlated, then you can find out where the system was.
So you're worried about the situation where an Alice measures, say, position, and Bob measures the momentum.
Yeah.
That's right?
Okay. Yeah. Then you can, if you say that it was one of the thing in the four you have updated to, then it you can deduce which one it was.
That's similar to the following fact about quantum theory. Alice and Bob could set up this entangled state. Alice could measure, you know, the z-spin on her system. Bob could measure the x-spin on his system. And they'll both get outcomes. So at the end of the day, they can say, you know, Alice can say, look, if you'd measured z-spin, you know, I could have told you what the outcome was. And you did measure x-spin, so you know the outcome there. So you have this possibility that, you know, for you have these two kinds of knowledge. In the regular quantum formalism, there's extra things to be known. You know, there's this underlying state space. And it is true that in some circumstances, you can find out everything about it. So here's an example that's clear, I think. If you have pre- and post-selection, okay, so suppose I prepare a spin to be in a z-spin eigenstate, and later I measure it in x along the x-axis. Okay, so if I ask, suppose a measurement of z-spin had been done in between, and it was measured according to a von Neumann projection postulate. Well, I would have been able to predict the outcome of that measurement, given this future information and the past information. I can predict what the outcome of that measurement would be by virtue of knowing that it was z ahead of time, so it's plus z here, and I know, say, that it's plus x later. So I can know what the outcome of this one is by virtue of knowing this. But if instead, in between, I had measured x, spin along x, I would also be able to predict what the outcome was, or retrodict what the outcome was, by virtue of knowing what it was later. So there's a sense in which if I slot into the middle one or the other, I can predict both. There's no trade-off in the predictability between this and the predictability of that in a scenario where I have pre- and post-selection. Okay? And it's the same with position and momentum. There's no trade-off between how much you know about position, how much you know about momentum, if you're allowed to condition on things in the past and things in the future. Okay, so that's a funny aspect of quantum theory. And it's the same in this sort of theory. There are situations where you can figure out what both the position and momentum are when you can combine two different kinds of information, like information about the past and the future.
Yeah, that means that you cannot assign a particular state. You cannot say it was in one particular state, otherwise you...
I would have said that the significance is that you have to be very careful in how you state the postulate, because you have to say, well, there's a limitation on how much you can know about position momentum in those scenarios where your information is not of this form, where you have information about the future and the past. So you have to be very careful to ensure that your postulate doesn't forbid something that you can actually do, namely learn position and momentum at some intermediate time based on all this extra information. Yes?
But this situation does not violate the uncertainty principle, because if you make different measurements, effectively we have different physical situations. Yes. So it's not like we're measuring position and the same thing.
Well, the regular uncertainty principle is also about two different counterfactual scenarios. So say this is a device for measuring position, this is a device for measuring momentum. It says that if I have a preparation procedure here, state rho, the regular uncertainty principle tells me that if I measured a position and I got a variance of outcomes delta x, then were I to have measured momentum, I would have gotten a variance delta p of outcomes. So it's not a statement about a joint measurement of position momentum. There are forms of the uncertainty principle that constrain how much you can know about a joint measurement of position momentum. There's, remember, these are these noisy joint measurements of position momentum that involve POVMs. So there is a form of the uncertainty principle that looks like that. But the kind that you hear about in textbooks is all about predictions for two different kinds of measurements. It's a trade-off. If you've got good predictability about one kind of measurement, then you'll have bad predictability about the other kind of memory. And so in that sense, this is similar. You're thinking of one or another measurement happening between pre and the post-selection. Yes?
What I find curious about all these things, you only study one physical principle, but it's kind of like the second law of thermodynamics, the knowledge you can get. And you have this geometric setting, right? So it's a 2 points with this particular discrete phase space. So could you, in principle, like reduce all of quantum mechanics with some algebra or geometry of the base space and then construct everything out of that principle, of that restriction of the knowledge you can have?
I don't know if you can or you can't. But I would say the motivation for this kind of exercise was to say, let's start somewhere where we have no interpretational problems, where we know what we're talking about. So don't introduce mathematics that comes, you know, without interpretation. So we introduce a phase space where we say, these are the ontic states. We know what that means. We introduce probability distributions over there. It's just classical probability theory. So at every stage, we have a solid interpretation of what's going on. And the hope is, you know, try to get quantum mechanics out the other side. So what you have to be careful of, if you go the route of mathematical abstraction, and I think there's been a lot of great success in physics just by saying, we have this mathematical structure. Let's abstract. Let's do something else and get something that's empirically adequate. That's great. But when you do that, sometimes you're forced to say, the only interpretation I can have of the resulting theory is an operational one. Because I don't know, you know, if, for example, you're not using the rules of classical probability theory, then it's not clear that you can say, this object represents somebody's knowledge of what's going on. And so that's the, if you're doing foundations, then you have to always bear in mind that, you know, you might be only working on the project of axiomatization if you've introduced mathematics which doesn't have a clear interpretation. If you want to furthermore work on the project of interpretation, then you have to be very careful that every, you know, new mathematical structure you introduce, you understand what its significance is. Okay, what's in there?
Yeah,